Yeah, so the thing about Facebook groups is that you end up in a community of people who believe the same thing. And in a lot of these Facebook groups, let's say you join a Facebook group about natural childbirth. If you express views to the contrary, often the moderators will simply kick you out. And so it leaves the people who remain in these echo chambers with the deeply inaccurate perception that there is widespread agreement with these ideas, when in reality, you could be in a group that's espousing very fringe ideas or very dangerous ideas. And a lot of moms end up in them.
Hi, this is Danae. I'm the founder of Simple Families. Simple Families is an online community for parents who are seeking a simpler, more intentional life. In this show, we focus on minimalism with kids, positive parenting, family wellness, and decreasing the mental load. My perspectives are based in my firsthand experience raising kids, but also rooted in my PhD in child development. So you're going to hear conversations that are based in research, but more importantly, real life. Thanks for joining us. Hi, Danae here. Thanks for tuning in. That voice you heard in the intro and my guest today is Kara Alimo. Kara is the author of the brand new book, Over the Influence, Why Social Media is Toxic for Women and Girls and How We Can Take It Back. In my chat with Kara today, we are going to talk about being influenced as parents and how we can be more mindful as our kids start to walk into this online world as well, to guide them in a way that they can be more thoughtful consumers. I want to tell you that some of the content that we're talking about today is a little bit sensitive, so you may want to preview it before listening to it in front of young children. Before we get into this chat, I have a 1 minute word from today's sponsor, PrepDish. PrepDish has been a staple in my house for many years. PrepDish is a meal planning service, so each week in my inbox, I get a PDF. That PDF is in three parts. There's an ingredient list to make the shopping really easy. There's a prep day list to know what we can do in advance to make getting the dish on the table super easy. I see clients on Sunday morning, so it's become the routine in our house for my kids to get some relaxing screen time on Sunday mornings while my partner tackles the prep day list, which is a great way for us to divide and conquer since I'm usually the one that's executing the dishes and getting them on the table the day of. PrepDish has hugely reduced my mental load when it comes to meal planning. In fact, I recently found an old book of recipes that I used pre-PrepDish, and I felt overwhelmed just looking at it. So if you're looking to simplify meal planning, try it out. Go to prepdish.com/families and you'll get 2 weeks free. That's prepdish.com/families and you'll get 2 weeks free. Without further ado, here's my chat with Kara. Hi, Kara. Thanks for joining me today.
I'm delighted to be with you.
I really enjoyed your book, which just came out this month. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
This is your first book. You wrote a textbook too, right?
I wrote a textbook, but Over the Influence is my first trade book that you'd buy on Amazon or at your local bookstore.
Right. So how long has this been in the works?
I started writing it while I was on maternity leave with my second daughter. And at that point, I had been writing for CNN Opinion since 2016 about issues affecting women and girls and about the social impact of social media. And so I'm home with my newborn, feeding her. And of course, anytime something happens that I might write about, my husband sends me a text. So he sends me this text, and it might seem like a small thing. The story was that Jill Biden had walked onto an airplane. That was the story. And according to Glamour Magazine's website, Twitter broke. And the reason was because of her stockings. She was wearing stockings. There was a huge debate. Were they fishnets? Were they not fishnets? Was she a prostitute? Was she a witch? Was she properly representing our country? And something in me just snapped in thinking about how here's this woman representing the country without earning a salary for it and what she was up against. And for me, it was a metaphor for what so many of us as women and as mothers are up against in our society. And I started writing this book and I just kind of didn't stop. And so the result is my book, Over the Influence, Why Social Media is Toxic for Women and Girls and How We Can Take It Back.
I love that. I have had a very conflicted relationship with social media over the past many years of parenthood. Yes. Where are you at now? So you wrote this book. Are you zero tolerance for social media? Are you completely off, or do you, have you found a balance?
So I had this moment enforcing myself, of course, to use social media to promote this book. And one of the pieces I wrote about this book is an op-ed for the LA Times. And the editor asked me to answer the question, if you say that social media is so toxic for women and girls, why should we use it at all? And where I netted out with this was really that social media is a tool for empowering ourselves. So whether it's me promoting my book, or whether it's girls finding lifelines when they are minorities in their physical communities, or kids developing interests that can turn into careers, I think social media can be a powerful tool for connecting with people in our fields, for promoting ourselves. And so I don't think it's right to tell women and girls not to use it. No judgment if it doesn't work for you. But my mission with this book is to help change the way we use social media, but also force lawmakers and tech companies to change what social networks look like so that they can be places where we can empower ourselves rather than places where we're left feeling like you and I feel after using Instagram.
Yes. And as you say in your book, mothers are sort of the perfect targets for this issue because so many of them, after giving birth to their first child, are isolated. You know, they're home taking care of a newborn. And what else is there to do when you're home taking care of a newborn than to sort of immerse yourself in what's going on outside of the house in a way that is usually happening through your phone?
Of course. And when I was holding my young babies and feeding them, which takes a lot of time, as we all know, there wasn't much else I could do with my hands other than scroll. And so I definitely felt like I spent more time on social media during that time than ever before. Of course, in the first weeks, especially, I was trying to keep my kids away from germs. So trying not to see a lot of people. So yes, moms are isolated and moms are extremely online. And very savvy people have learned that we are therefore vulnerable to misinformation and to other schemes. So one of the things I write about in my book is misinformation targeted to women that ultimately makes us feel less than or provides very dangerous advice to us. So I talk about all the advice on social media about having home births. And full disclosure, you know, I married a doctor. I believe in the medical system. I also believe that doctors often don't listen to women. And in fact, that was my experience during my first delivery. So I understand where a lot of the content that moms are seeing online is coming from. But a lot of it, you know, tells women to have a home birth. Babies are much more likely to die when delivered as part of planned home births than when delivered in a hospital. You know, childbirth is a major medical event and complications can arise without warning that require complex interventions. So I believe that women belong in hospitals with doctors who listen to us. I also believe that we deserve pain medication. I'm not sure where this whole movement to tell women to forgo safe, effective pain medicine is coming from, other than a place of sort of deeply rooted misogyny, because I never hear men told not to take the anesthesia when they have surgery or when they have very complex medical procedures. And so I'm worried about all of the content that is targeted to moms when we're most vulnerable. And there's so many people who are trying to provide things like recipes for homemade baby formula when we know that, unfortunately, you can't make baby formula at home. Needs a complex mix of ingredients that can't be bought at the grocery store. And so moms are targeted with all of these things, often with misinformation, that one can cause us to make very dangerous decisions on behalf of ourselves or our children, but two often leave us feeling less than, right? So I'm not the best mom because I couldn't deliver quote unquote naturally, or I'm not the best mom because I do give my kid a screen when we're on an airplane, whatever it is. And you know, that can be so damaging.
Can you explain to us a little bit about echo chambers and how things like Facebook groups can be echo chambers and maybe we don't realize it?
Yeah, so the thing about Facebook groups is that you end up in a community of people who believe the same thing. And in a lot of these Facebook groups, let's say you join a Facebook group about natural childbirth. If you express views to the contrary, often the moderators will simply kick you out. And so it leaves the people who remain in these echo chambers with the deeply inaccurate perception that there is widespread agreement with these ideas, when in reality, you could be in a group that's espousing very fringe ideas or very dangerous ideas. And a lot of moms end up in them.
Right. I'm sort of reconciling this in my brain. So I had my kids unmedicated, and I guess I was never involved in a community that told me I should do that. Like, I think that I wanted to do that, and now looking back, I'm really glad that I did that. It was a wonderful experience for me. So what you're saying is that often what's happening in these groups is that some women are sort of being given these ideas and made feel like they're wrong if they are not executing fully on these ideas because of the social pressures within the group, which is very one-sided.
Exactly. So a lot of
Okay.
influencers will post that they didn't use pain medication during childbirth. And of course, everyone's experiences are different. With my first delivery, I was in excruciating, sort of impossible to describe pain. My later doctor told me that I had a condition that caused it, and that the solution was, of course, pain medication.
Right.
And you know, when I arrived at the hospital, you know, they tried to send me home and told me I wasn't in labor. My daughter was born later that morning, and so I, having been through this experience myself and having very much needed pain medication, I'm worried about all of this content on social media telling moms you're not a good mom if you don't forgo the pain medication. You know, the majority of women end up getting pain medication, and the majority of women are happy with it. So for women who need it, which is most of us,
Yeah.
according to the statistics, I don't think that there should be guilt or shame involved in needing it, just as men don't feel guilt or shame when they get anesthesia when they're having medical procedures.
Yeah. I'm doing the mental gymnastics in my head thinking about this when, we're making a decision. How do we decide if a decision is like my decision, which I guess I more or less kind of reflecting back, it's been 8, 10 years now. That was my intent, was to go without medication, but it was never like this all or nothing. But now I'm like, how did I come to that decision? Was it socially pressured, or was it my own decision within me and something I wanted for myself? And how do we kind of weigh those decisions when we are making choices? How do we piece it apart? What is mine versus what I've been influenced into online?
Oh my goodness, that's so interesting and so tricky to untangle, right? I guess I think the thing that we need to be mindful of on social media is that so many moms are presenting what worked for them as what works best for everyone. And you and I know that, you know, when it comes to parenting children, every child is different. What works for my first child doesn't necessarily work for my second child. And so I think that when we're consuming social media content, at least, the thing to bear in mind is that someone is sharing something that worked for them and that may or may not work for you. And so if it works for you and it's safe and effective, fabulous. But if it doesn't, it doesn't mean you're a lesser woman or a lesser mom. It means you have a different life, a different child, a different
Yeah.
body, a different reality. And you know, what particularly scares me about some of the people who are pushing these ideas heavily on moms is that they're not credentialed. They're often not people with medical expertise. Sometimes sharing ideas that are dangerous out of ignorance, but sometimes it's because they want you to buy their essential oils and they want you to sign up for their boot camp. And this is, you know, a big industry. I mean, people make a lot
Yeah.
of money off of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting you bring up the credentialed piece, because when I was sharing more on social media, I really, for the past 2 years, have been largely off of Instagram, which is where I used to share quite a bit of my, both my personal life and my professional expertise. My PhD is in child development, so I shared a lot of child behavior content, a lot of parenting content. And in early 2022, I kind of, so that was about the time that Reels were coming out on Instagram, and that's where I spent a lot of time, was on Instagram. And I, as soon as Reels came out, I was like, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to be here anymore. This doesn't feel good to me anymore. When Reels first came out, people were sort of like dancing and like pointing to words on the screen. And yes. I'm like, you know, I went to school for a really long time to be like dancing and pointing in a 1 minute video on Instagram. Like, that's just not how I want to be conveying information. That's not how I want to be teaching. That's not how I want to be, you know, living my life at this point. No judgment to anyone that does, but that just didn't feel like the right choice for me. And so that was January 2022. I started to feel like there was so much coming at us from so many angles, especially being a mom from a parenting perspective. And even though, you know, from my education and my work experience, I have a lot of sort of base level knowledge in the parenthood realm, I still felt completely overwhelmed and inundated by everything that was hitting my feed, which made me sort of wonder, how are other moms feeling? Like, they must be feeling completely overwhelmed and completely inundated by people like me who are putting really well-intentioned information out there on the internet. And around this time, there was a parenting influencer who exploded online and shares amazing, wonderful information. And I really don't disagree with any of it. But simultaneously, I started to get an increase in referrals of mothers who were coming to my office, sitting on my sofa, saying, I'm seeing this content from this influencer online, and I've learned so much, but I can't implement it. What's wrong with me? Mm-hmm. Right. So this sort of parallel that I'm seeing of, you know, you're learning so much in these 1 minute reels and these little squares on Instagram, and you feel like you have all this knowledge, but you can't implement it successfully, and you feel like you're failing. And these were amazing, amazing moms that I was seeing. And this was like mid 2022. And I still see this all the time. I see women coming in naming one specific influencer in particular, but several, in that it's sort of like this conundrum of like, if all this information is out there, why can't I do it? Why can't I execute on it? Why can't I just figure it all out? I don't know if you hear that, but it's something, and that's sort of has motivated me to stay off the internet in my online content sharing, is that I feel like there's already so much out there, and we don't need one more voice, my voice or any others, kind of overwhelming women when so many of them are doing way, way better than they know and way good enough as it is.
So I really want to talk about what your story says about other moms who try to influence, because there's so many of them. But I'm just curious, did you find that it was the case, because the influencer you're talking about, who I can picture in my head and I follow her content too, is sharing content that is really smart but might not apply? Or is it because it takes more than 30 seconds to learn how to apply advice in the context of your very complex family?
The latter. Yeah. The you know, you can't get a PhD on Instagram. And I think that's what we're trying to do. And I think the ideas are much bigger than what can be shared in a reel. And then when we try to consolidate such complex information into such a small bit of time, it feels so simple and so tangible, but the reality is, I would say 95% of all humans are going to have a hard time implementing it, right? It's like sharing tax, like how to do your taxes in a 1 minute reel and not get arrested for tax fraud. Like, I mean, good luck.
Instagram, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
But just to go back to what you were sharing about your experience as basically an influencer sharing this content, I think the thing is, a lot of moms are trying to be influencers. So the vast majority of influencers are women. And you can see why, because a lot of us need flexible jobs so that we can pick up our kids or handle the situation when our kids are sick and home from school all the time. And so a lot of moms find that we can't work a traditional 9-to-5, or who are we kidding, you know, 8-to-6 job. And that's why I think so many moms are turning to influencing. I think 20 years ago, these women would have been writing articles for women's magazines and for newspapers. But now all of the money that used to pay them to do that, the advertising dollars that used to go to magazines and newspapers, are, as we all know, going to Facebook and Google. And so now a lot of moms are trying to make some side money by influencing. And so, you know, one of the things I say in my book is we really can't judge them too harshly, right? These are women with very complicated circumstances themselves often. We have to remember that a lot of moms can't find validation in other places in our society. And so this is a way to try to make a little bit of money, try to get some validation. And everyone thinks that influencing is so glamorous, but the reality is most influencers make very little money. I think the average income for a woman influencer is something like $12,000 a year now for all that hard work creating content. And it can also be really disheartening to have to spend so much time making such little money, responding to followers and trying to project this perfect life that you need to project in order to attract brand sponsors. And everyone knows that if you're a mom, you know, you don't easily come by a pristine home and, you know, smiling children in unwrinkled dresses.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think kind of thinking back to all the moms who have been on my sofa and sort of sharing this feeling of not being good enough, when the vast majority, maybe all of them, are plenty good enough, which is, it feels challenging for me to see that, right? This feeling that we have set up for women is that even when you're doing an amazing job, you feel like you're not doing enough. And I think that this, the impact that this has had is something that we didn't foresee, right? And especially even myself, like I've been a part of this, of sharing information online. Like, I guess I'm doing that right now in this podcast. Sure. But how do we sort of look one step further than all of the information that how do we look one step further than putting the information out there and thinking about what the impact of that information is going to have on people? Maybe at some it's positive, maybe some it's less positive. And it feels like it puts us as a consumer in this position where we have to be really critical in our analysis of what we're going to consume and what is really making us feel better and not worse. And it's really hard to separate that.
I think that's exactly right. I interviewed another therapist for my book who said that, you know, as moms, we love our children so much that we are so vulnerable because we're always worried about whether we're doing things the right way or the wrong way. And that just comes with motherhood, right? And I imagine existed before social media came along. But now I think it's so important to think about the content we're consuming and whether it's serving us and whether it's healthy. And if you are consuming content from a particular influencer and it's leaving you feeling less than, or it's just not applicable to your life or easily implemented in your life, the best thing to do is to just unfollow. There are moms out there who share their messy homes and authentic sides of parenting. It feels like there's less of them because it's hard to sell products when you're not projecting an Insta-worthy life, but they're out there. And so I think it's just important to mindfully ask yourself that question on a regular basis.
Yeah, I've started to use that question, you know, how does it make you feel in regard to online content with young girls and, well, middle school girls, young teenagers in my therapy practice. And, you know, I have some older elementary school age even that are already a part of this content creating and content watching group. There are some that are on TikTok and they're already watching, you know, the skincare content and the beauty content, how to put makeup on tutorials. You know, it's hard for me as an adult with a fully developed brain to distinguish between what makes me feel good and what doesn't make me feel good. But to put that question on an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old feels really, really difficult. But I don't know what else to do, right? You know, then other than getting them to look critically at how this stuff makes them feel. But I fully recognize that if it's hard for me, it's going to be really hard for them.
I think that's exactly right. And I think so much of it is because of what's happening to them during puberty. So last week I was recording some podcasts, my kids were homesick. And so I was trying to explain to my very young daughter why my work was so important that I was leaving her with a screen to do it. And I was having a conversation about consent. And I said to her, I was talking about what you should do if something makes you feel uncomfortable. And she looked at me like I had asked her the dumbest question in the world. And she said, well, obviously you would say no. Right. But she's in preschool. So now the question is, will she still say that when she's 13? And there was a really interesting study done in the UK that found that when girls between the ages of 11 and 13, which is the age they typically go through puberty, use social media, it was associated with lower life satisfaction a year later. And what that tells me, and I know this is easy to say and so hard to do as moms, is that girls who are going through puberty do not belong on social media. And to the extent that we can hold off a couple extra years, the research does suggest that it will make a big difference. We all know how hard it is to be a girl of that age. Your confidence is plummeting. Relationships are so important to you. Those become so fraught once you have Snapchat and you can see that all your friends are together and they didn't invite you. And so, one of the things I say is, if possible, it's a good idea to talk to other parents and collectively agree that you'll hold off on giving kids in your community, or in your kids' friend group phones until a particular age. And I think a year or two can make a difference because if you and I struggle with these things, I can only imagine what it's like to deal with them during puberty.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an important message that waiting a year or two even can make a huge difference because I think there are a lot of parents out there who sort of are telling themselves, well, I might as well just give it to them now because eventually they're going to have it. And it's going to be inevitable that they're going to be on social media all the time. They're going to be on their phone all the time, that sort of thing. And we lose sight of this idea that, our brains are still developing. And this stage, especially middle school, is a stage of rapid development. And they are more easily influenced than adults, and we're pretty easily influenced, I think we've proven.
That's
So,
right.
how can waiting a couple years actually really help our kids and give them a better opportunity, a better start, and improve their mental health? And I think that is absolutely true.
Yeah. And, it's hard. I think the thing to do is talk to other parents early. And see if you can stick to your guns. Another podcaster I was chatting with last week told me she offered her daughter $1,600 if she would wait until she was age 16 to get a phone. And her daughter took the money. Now that is obviously she's in a very privileged position to be able to do something like that. But I wouldn't fault parents for getting creative with things like that, offering kids other things they might badly want instead.
Right. Yeah. I have started the wait until eighth. For anyone not familiar, wait until eighth is a pledge that you can take with, I think you have to get 10 families in your child's class to pledge to wait until after eighth grade to give a smartphone. So I've started that conversation in one of my child's second grade classroom. And it feels a little bit crazy early. However, I mean, some of them are already FaceTiming and texting each other on their iPads. So, and at this age, it's cute, right? But then it's slowly this slippery slope that moves towards other things, which I think as parents, we have to be conscientious about because it's not even just the smartphones, right? It's having access to instant texting, which is very risky for kids who are still impulsive and don't fully think through the consequences of their actions, which we know in this fragile age range of, early childhood and even into the middle years, that they're very vulnerable to that.
I was just reading the news that broke this week about middle schoolers in Beverly Hills who created new deepfakes of their classmates. And, the kids in this school are between the ages of 11 and 14. If you need a reason to not let kids on phones until high school, here's another one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, oh my gosh, was it in your book? It was in your book. I'm like, I read so many books on this topic. I'm trying to I'm also very passionate about it. You were talking about how if a child receives a nude photo of another child, that that is considered child pornography.
Yeah.
Which I, it's not something I'd ever thought about like that when there's these photos are exchanged between children, which I don't know. I feel like you gave us percentages on what percentage of children in the teenage years or even in the young teen years are exchanging or receiving some sort of nude photographs.
Yeah, so sexting is just sort of commonplace among young kids right now. And I think that's one of the places where it's really important to lay down the line. One of the things I learned is sort of just how life-destroying it is for women and girls when their nude images are shared publicly. So when I was researching my book, I found, when a woman's nude images end up online, it puts her at greater risk of depression, at greater risk of suicide, at greater risk of sexual assault, makes it harder for her to get a job, it makes it harder for her to date. It can be life destroying. And, I interviewed one girl who explained to me that she and her friends would actually take nude images in advance and save them so that then when boys asked for them, they had them at the ready. And it just gutted me because, it's not something I grew up doing, but it's something that is so commonplace among this generation. I think we have to teach our daughters the possible repercussions of this. So certainly it's, life destroying if someone ends up hacking those photos on their phone or on someone else's phone, or if, you break up with the person you shared them with and then they decide to post them online. And then also there's the risk that actually a child could be prosecuted in theory for creating child pornography of themselves. It's a crime to have it on their phone. It's a crime to share it with a friend. And so it's just too extraordinarily dangerous. And I think we have to teach our daughters this. At the same time, I think it's very important for our kids to know that if they screw up, so let's say your daughter creates a, decides to sext anyway, that they can always come to you for help. Because I interviewed this attorney who prosecutes these kinds of cases or who takes on these kinds of cases. And she told me that she often sees a young girl will be in trouble, but afraid to go to her parents because she's afraid that her phone will be taken away. And so the situation just keeps getting worse and worse. A photo might keep circulating, or, a girl will be sextorted and someone will be asking her for money in order to not post that photo online. And she's just getting in deeper and deeper.
Yeah. And, I think there are so many parents out there thinking to themselves, well, my kid would never do that. Right. And that's something that I hear a lot from parents, this idea that I trust my kid. I'm going to give them an iPhone without any kind of parental controls or any limits because I trust them. And they're saying that about their 12 or 13-year-old. And I think it's wonderful and necessary to trust our kids. But it is also very risky when their brains are still rapidly developing and they still are subject to peer pressure. And things can happen, that it takes 1 second to take a photo, right? A photo that you may regret forever. And to think that any of our children are immune from making a poor decision, I think is a bit foolish for us as parents.
I think the thing to remind yourself of is that even though it's difficult for me to wrap my head around it, this practice is just a common part of youth culture right now. And yes, one bad decision, you could be paying for the rest of your life. And we know that girls in particular in our society are judged by very unforgiving standards.
Yeah. It's slightly slash absolutely terrifying to think about. But in our house, I tend to talk with my kids about everything, whether or not they want to hear it. And this is the sort of thing recently, actually, in our house, a teacher at one of my children's schools was arrested for child pornography, and which is an absolute horrendous thing to happen to the whole community. But it also has created this opportunity for a conversation about what that is and what it looks like and how it could impact all of us at any given time. And I mean, this was a very different situation with, this teacher was a fully grown adult. And the photos, I don't know the specifics of the photos, but were not children at the school. But the idea of nude photos, inappropriate photos on the internet is something that they will experience and they will see at some point. And how do we prepare them for that and know what's appropriate, what's inappropriate, and what to do when they come across it?
So that's another place where parents often think, oh, but my child won't view this. Some kids come across this, innocently and accidentally, or they search for something very innocent. But again, the statistics tell us that the vast majority of kids of all genders will be exposed to pornography at pretty young ages. And I think the thing that parents have to know is that the vast majority of pornography just depicts violence against women. And so it's just so important to talk about why that's unacceptable, but also why what they're seeing is not actually a good depiction of reality or isn't a good source of information that they're seeking so that they know it before they come across it. And unfortunately, we have to have these conversations.
It feels increasingly difficult to keep our kids safe in this aspect. You know, thinking about even though my children's devices are always fully locked down, we have a lot of restrictions and lots of different ways, router level, device level, you name it, in our house. So they're safe in our house. The way that I have the Wi-Fi set up is so that when friends come over, if they were to bring, they haven't yet, but if they were to bring devices, they wouldn't be able to access those things on our router at least. However, I have absolutely no control over the child that my kid sits next to on the bus,
That's
right?
right.
You know, I mean, I think their other devices are out there all the time, and I don't think that we can find any way to limit that because of that and our children's sort of social experience out in the world.
So that's where we have to be talking to our kids. We have to know that even if you don't use TikTok yourself a lot, that the Sephora Kids and Botox Babies content is what's trending right now, telling 10-year-olds to that they need makeup and Botox. And we need to have these conversations because we can't siphon them off from the world. I do think that your situation in your home is probably quite unique and that you're really savvy about protecting your kids' use of the internet. But a lot of parents have this misunderstanding that their kids are safer at home and therefore don't let them go out and do things with their friends offline. And, actually, if your kid's upstairs, chatting with a predator on a social app, they're in much greater danger than if you just let them go to the mall with their friends. So it sounds like obvious advice, but I think, making sure that our kids have a healthy mix of activities, extracurricular activities is really important because you can't be on your phone when you're playing in a basketball game or whatever it is that interests them. And I do think it's important to make sure that our kids are able to get together with their friends in person, even though those friends may have devices that they share with questionable content and all that. But that, sometimes your kids are still better off with another 14-year-old than with, the 40-year-old pedophile they could be connecting with on Instagram, right?
Yes, I'd say 100% of the time, yeah, that would be the case. You know, but that brings up a very important, I don't mean to laugh at that. I think it just, sorry. It felt
Agreed.
like an almost ridiculous example, but it's not, is the unfortunate truth, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the pandemic sort of escalated this situation where we feel safer with our kids at home. And that messaging, you know, and it was very, very important that home was the safer place to be for a long time. But it feels like maybe that has sunk so deep into our psyches that now, with our kids growing, that it's hard to let them out into the world. And we know that things like drug use and teen pregnancy, those are going down, but then mental health challenges are going up, and that kids are safer from perhaps a physical standpoint at home, but from a mental health standpoint, that those risks are increasing as they get older and they have, you know, this evolutionary need to get out and explore and to grow and to separate.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And so, again, the more you allow your kids to go outside of your house, the less time they spend online, which is, I think the root of a lot of the mental health challenges that so many kids are facing. If you're with your friends in person, you know what a normal body image looks like. And if you are instead scrolling on your phone in your bedroom, you think that the Instagram body is normal when, of course, in reality, it's rarely achieved without surgery. And so I think being in the offline world gives people a healthier sense of what that actually is, rather than the heavily filtered, idealized world of Instagram, for instance.
Absolutely. And as parents, I think we need to constantly be kind of evaluating that in our brain, what safety really means to our kids and what they need as they grow, even if it feels hard to give them some of that space. And I
Yes.
mean, I don't know, I think I'm really leaning into those, having those conversations with my kids so that they can be equipped with the information, because I am not going to necessarily be right next to them all the time.
That's exactly it.
But I can't possibly cover all the bases. There's always going to be surprises, right?
But I think, part of it is parents are often afraid to have these conversations or feel like they don't know how if you're not on the same apps as your kids, right? So you might think, well, but I don't use Snapchat or I don't use TikTok. So like, what do I have to offer my kids? And that's where, you know, conversations about not doing things that make you feel uncomfortable, the fact that they're going to come across pornography and what it looks like, the fact that they shouldn't connect with adults who they don't know. These are conversations that you have to have and that you can have without knowing how to make a really great story on Instagram. So you don't need tech savvy in order to be savvy about teaching your kids these just really important life lessons and teaching them about the threats that they're going to encounter online.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's uncomfortable for us as parents too. I've been sort of navigating this with some of the other parents at my child's school after this arrest and sort of how to sort of, what do we say to them? And there was a large group of parents who, you know, wanted to say that there was a gas leak at the school or there was some, that's why school was canceled for a couple of days. And so something else was going on and they didn't want to talk to them. And, you know, for me, I sat down with my 10-year-old and read the news article and we talked about what the charges were and what that means. And it felt like a teachable moment that was uncomfortable because we were talking about things that are unsafe and scary. But if I don't talk about them, then they may find them out in the real world in other ways that are sort of less data driven, less fact informed.
Yeah, I interviewed an intersectional health educator for my book, and she talked about all the pushback from parents when she tries to teach things like porn literacy, which, to be clear, is not showing kids porn. It's telling them, you know, about the unhealthy depictions of reality that are in these, you know, in them. And so I think as parents, it's really important for us to be on the side of educating our kids and letting people who are informed and have credentials and know how to do this also give them the sex education that they need. Because that's ultimately what will teach kids to say no when they feel uncomfortable and give them a healthy sense of what they're seeing when they're pretty much inevitably exposed to it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Kara, I am so happy for your book to hit the world. I really enjoyed reading it and it made me feel more empowered and gave me a lot of ideas on things to say and use with my own kids and with my clients. So I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you've enjoyed this chat with Kara Alimo. I recommend you check out her new book, Over the Influence. You can find it wherever books are sold. Thanks for tuning in. I'll chat with you next month.